Welcome to For the Health of It, starring Dr. Jennifer Kretzinger, wellness chiropractor. She is joined by her co-host Jessica and producer Mike Clark. They will inspire you to eat, move, sleep, think, and live better.
We are back in the studio, and we are going to do part two of our series on Lyme disease. We're so fortunate to have Dr. Margaret Miklas here in the studio. She is a naturopathic physician practicing here in New Hampshire, and she's a graduate of the Kripalu School of Ayurveda and current faculty. She actually completed a physician's training program through the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society, and she is now a Lyme specialist here right in New Hampshire. She actually practices in Nashua. Her office is called Living Natural Incorporated, INC. And I tell you, our first series that we did, the first show, there was so much information that I was happy to hear and excited to share with you, because there's so much unknown and not understood about Lyme disease. So I thank you for being here, Dr. Miklas.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do for this segment is talk first about just some clinical studies. Maybe give us a picture of what someone coming in looks like who either has been diagnosed with Lyme, you've recently diagnosed, or maybe we aren't able to get a positive test but highly suspect, and maybe talk us through what their treatment protocols were.
Sure. Well, I might mention just, I think when you live in an area where there is an illness that's endemic, I think you have to really think of it as a differential diagnosis for almost anything. I probably mentioned that before. And so when I see a client in my clinical practice that has been diagnosed or that I diagnose, there are standard protocols that you can certainly employ in order to treat. And you know, most people know that the tetracycline class of drug is a very common and first line treatment for treating adult Lyme disease, particularly early onset, I would say. So let's say in a perfect scenario, the person gets bit by a tick, they get a bullseye rash, they get a flu like illness, they go to a conventional doctor, and the doctor decides maybe they even have a titer test and the titer comes back positive. Maybe they even go forward to do a Western blot and the Western blot comes back positive. It's a clear. This is the perfect case, right? This is the person's going to get hopefully the appropriate treatment. Now, for an adult, a very common treatment would be 100 milligrams of doxycycline twice a day for, say, 2 weeks. Now, in my opinion, that is a bit of a short prescription, especially if all those clinical aspects, those features are part of the picture. So they have the bite, they've got the bullseye rash, they have the flu-like illness. International guidelines state that you treat 2 months post all symptoms resolve. And I follow those guidelines in my clinical practice. So again, that perfect scenario, a person gets bit by a tick, they get a bullseye rash, they get a flu-like illness, they are going to be treated 2 months post all symptoms resolve. It's a very effective treatment, in my opinion, for acute Lyme that is a full resolution. Now, with children, it's different. So kids in developmental stages, you can't use the tetracycline class of drugs because they affect bones and teeth. And so if the teeth have not come in, I oftentimes don't use at all the tetracycline class. There are certain cases where you can use like a miminocycline, for a neurological case. But typically speaking, the standard, line of treatment would be to use something like an amoxicillin. So that is one of the first choices, broad spectrum antibiotic. Some people that are, allergic to the penicillin class of drugs can't use that. So there are other drugs. But again, and you typically do when I treat with, let's say amoxicillin, just because we're talking about that drug. So it would be 40 milligrams per kilogram of body weight of the child in order to treat them. And again, doing it 2 months post all symptoms resolve. In my opinion, this is the best way. This is the fullest resolution. Now, typically speaking, that's not the treatment that's going to be offered. And so, usually there's a shorter course. I would like to just mention quickly that oftentimes if there is a tick bite, I hear in my clinical practice that a client may have gone to another practitioner and received a single dose of doxycycline or amoxicillin or whatever it was, I do not value that as a treatment. I don't believe it is a treatment. I don't know of any clinical trials that they've done in order to establish that as a treatment. And I say it again because, you know, we have just touched a little bit on some of the myths of Lyme. And I think that this is a real sketchy area where we don't really know that if the infection is going to be, if the infection is actually even remotely treated by. I personally don't think with this particular organism, this spirochete, that that is actually a valued treatment that will do anything for a client.
Now, do you know of any cases of people who are successfully able to treat an acute case of Lyme without an antibiotic?
That's a really good question. I think that people do make claims that that's the case. It's not something in my clinical practice that I'm willing to take the risk. You know, we've talked, you know this about my practice. I use integrative medicine. I don't believe antibiotics are the only answer. You know, Lyme is, again, about infection, immune dysfunction, you know, and inflammation. And, you know, the antibiotics can help with a lot of that. But I think that the benefit outweighs the risk to, in an acute setting, to do antibiotic therapy with integrative medicine. So, you know, what that looks like in my clinical practice, that same person gets bit by a tick, they have a bullseye rash, they get a flu-like illness. This is what, you know, they get a Lyme diagnosis. You know, I'm looking at their constitution. I'm saying, okay, yes, would doxycycline be reasonable? Sure, let's try it out. Doxycycline actually has been a really effective drug in my practice. Let's try that, but let's do some other things. Let's do some herbs to support that. There was a great study, I think it was printed in the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients. It was done in 2010, the University of New Haven. Eva Sappi is the PhD there in charge of that study. It was on doxycycline and Salmento, which is cat's claw, and I think Banderol. And actually, it was an extremely effective in vitro study. And so I don't want to ever, I mean, I'm a naturopathic doctor. I want to believe that herbal medicine is the answer for this illness. I believe integrative medicine is the answer, you know, for this particular illness. And that, in my opinion, the benefit outweighs the risk. You know, people talk about dysbiosis, antibiotic resistance. If you're treating somebody for a month or two on antibiotics, in my opinion, this is not a problem for treatment. You use things like probiotics. You use, you know, other nutritional protocols, other phytotherapy to really help them through that process. And typically speaking, the person's going to be able to tolerate that treatment. And so, you know, it would be, in my opinion, it would be great. It would be great. Wouldn't it be great if there was 1, 2, 3 herbs that we could pull from to you know, treat this illness? And I'm not suggesting that there aren't, but I would say that because of the destructive aspects of acquiring Lyme disease and the way that it operates in the body, I believe the benefit outweighs the risk to do integrative medicine and to use antibiotic therapy.
Well, I think you just said a key component. If you're doing a probiotic and phytonutrients, ways to support the body, so any negative aspect of an antibiotic, basically wiping out the healthy flora in the gut, making sure the patient's re-inoculated with a probiotic, that's a really key component. So long-term, they don't develop gut problems or digestive problems.
And I think, you know, the power of nature enables us to really, you know, what I tell people, if, you know, lots of my clients, because, you know, they're more oriented with natural therapeutics, they're concerned, like, I don't really want to go on an antibiotic for that long. And I say, look, we can clean up any mess. The power of nature allows us to do that. Probiotics is a standard treatment in my clinical practice. It's almost rare, if not at all, that anybody that I prescribe antibiotics. I've had 1 or 2 patients, funny enough, have some negative reaction with probiotics, but typically speaking, that's in, you know, my going on 7 years of clinical practice. For the most part, people are on a human microflora in my clinical practice, and they take it 2 hours before or after their antibiotic therapy, 1 time a day. I've never had a C. difficile. I've never, if I have any gut dysbiosis, or let's say some sort of candida issue, I might use something like a Saccharomyces, you know, like a Boulardii. But for the most part, there's no issue. And, you know, I'm always monitoring liver and kidney function also. So I'm looking at what are the other components, what are the other things that are going on with the client, making sure that they're in check, that they can tolerate this level of treatment. And so, again, going back to the fact that the benefit outweighs the risk.
Now, I would suspect a chronic case, say someone who's come in that's potentially had Lyme for 5-10 years, that would be a potentially a different scenario as far as treatment goes.
Absolutely. And again, it's like what I was saying before, some of those people might respond to long-term antibiotic therapy, some of those people might not. But what I think everybody can respond to is really finding the most, you know, the best and most applicable individual treatment that, you know, works for them. And so what does that mean? So if it's a severe, a lot of patients that are coming in that I have that have ALS have Lyme disease. And so, you know, and I know that they're doing a big study. I think it's the person who's in charge of this clinical trial is Dr. David at Mass General. He's the ALS specialist there. They're doing a study on IV rocephin in ALS. And so it's interesting, again, here we are using antibiotic therapy, you know, IV rocephin, in order to really, you know, identify whether or not this can be a help. There was a big minocycline study done with ALS. And so, but these patients, there's a out in Colorado Springs, there's a doctor who does a lot of work with the Lou Gehrig's patients and a lot of these chronic, really neurological cases. And what she has expressed to me with her clinical practice, because she has so much of this population, is that you really need to be really careful with these people in antibiotic therapy, because they can flare up and they're already so you know, challenged with their neurological system that you can really flare them up and cause a real negative outcome. So I think with the chronic patients, it's a much trickier population. And this is why I emphasize really, let's get it taken care of early on so that we don't have to deal with this chronic issue coming down the pike.
Yeah, in the cases that I've seen of patients where I really suspect Lyme, you're right, the chronic cases, it's just a myriad of different symptoms, and some of them can just be devastating from a lifestyle perspective. Mm-hmm. I think what I'd like to do is let's go to break, and when we come back, I really want to dig into some of your ideas and opinions about where this disease came from. Is it old? Is it new? Is it man-made? How did this happen to us?
Sure, thank you.
You're listening to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it. Your host is Dr. Jennifer Kretzinger, wellness chiropractor at Spinal Corrective Center in Amherst, New Hampshire. For more information about Dr. Jennifer or this podcast, check out spinalcorrectivecenter.com. If you would like to schedule a health checkup with Dr. Jennifer, call 603-673-5600 and mention this podcast to receive a special offer. That's 603-673-5600. To find a wellness chiropractor in your area, go to chiropractic.org/doctorfinder. Now, back to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it.
We're back. We have Dr. Margaret Miklas, a naturopathic physician at Living Natural Inc. in Nashua, New Hampshire. You can find her online at livingnaturalinc.com. And we're going to dig right into where did Lyme disease come from? And interestingly, at break, Dr. Miklas was saying how actually the research has discovered that this is maybe a very, very old spirochete.
Yes, this is true. Everybody can go. I think it was probably, you know, NPR, Nova, I think, or one of those public television segments on the Iceman. And if you Google this or go on YouTube, you can find some good videos that they've just discovered. They did DNA testing on the Iceman. I think he's in the Swiss Alps area that they found. He's 5,300 years old, and they found Lyme DNA. And so this was sort of the aha moment, I would say, for lots of people, like, okay, wow, this is really much older than we thought. And, you know, I think with lots of the theory about, you know, Lyme, Connecticut and Lab 257 and some of these other, you know, supposedly conspiracy theories that are out there, how true they are, I don't know. Maybe they are really true. Maybe there's something in, you know, in the middle. But the reality is obviously there was a resurgence of, you know, Lyme Borrelia that happened in Lyme, Connecticut. And there are people that believe that this had something to do with, you know, a biological lab. But the reality is Lyme in my opinion, is potentially everywhere on this globe. You know, I've heard things like that they found, you know, the Lyme spirochete in, you know, Antarctica in the middle of winter. And so, but you look, you know, there's pockets, you know, there's a whole European Lyme community because there's areas in Europe that have prevalence, you know, just like us here in the Northeast. So Romania, Austria, Germany, there's some folks, Italy, I would say, have diagnosed patients in Italy. And so what we have to be aware of is that, again, this is a spirochete. If we accept that it's an old illness and not, you know, from the 1970s or 60s, then we're accepting that there's a greater potential. And so, you know, we have multiple subspecies of, you know, Borrelia burgdorferi.
There are areas that are more concentrated, though, right?
There are areas that are more concentrated, and I think, you know, it would be, you know, prudent to just talk about, you know, climate. Like, why is it that we're seeing, you know, lots of changes with infectious disease? You know, the World Health Organization has lots to say about this, but why are we seeing lots of changes with infectious disease and microbiology as our climate changes? And that's a whole other segment, a whole other path that you could follow. But I think there is something to it. You know, why is this disease spreading so rapidly? It's not just about the ticks. It is about the ticks, and it is about the deer. But, you know, there's other reasons.
Yeah, I've actually met people who are ready to just, you know, move to New Mexico because they have this fear that if you live in New England, inevitably you'll contract Lyme disease. And, you know, as a clinician myself, I can't actually say, no, that won't happen, because it does seem like the prevalence is becoming more and more.
People
and more.
Are terrified too.
Well, it's not even outside. I was teaching a yoga class and I saw a tick coming towards my mat inside. I don't know where that came from.
If I was a tick, I'd bite you too.
Hey. Stay away from
actually,
me.
On that note, I was at a cafe the other day and there was a tick climbing on the wall. And I literally saw a man like go into a rage and, like, as you were saying in the last segment, mutilate the tick because there's this fear around it. What do you do when you see, say, a tick is just crawling on the floor? What should we do with that tick?
I mean, it's really, you know, if it's crawling on the floor, I mean, I think there's, you know, and they certainly say, like, with one of the other prevention aspects, like when you're outside, like say you're in an area where you know that there's a lot of ticks, you know, bringing your clothes in and putting them in the dryer so that the heat is actually going to, you know, it's funny because I have people bring me their ticks all the time. So I have, you know, jars of them. I have just, I mean, they're, you know, what are you going to do with them? I mean, some people burn them. Some people think that fat, I've had people say, yeah, well, I put Vaseline on them and killed them. And, you know, I would say, you know, ultimately, you know, I don't know that any one way is a better way as far as like disposing them of, you know, of them. But, you know, certainly I think disposing of it would be a reasonable thing to consider. You know, I don't know that I would go as far as, you know, burning it or, putting something on it, but I think, you know, reasonable enough to collect it and, you know, dispose of it appropriately. You know, I don't think you need to send it off to any lab. There's so many of them that are crawling around, but, you know, certainly in your house and your dog's like, what do you do with them? Do you kill them? And most people do end up killing them, I would say.
One thing that I've heard not to do is just don't just flush it down the toilet. I actually had a patient. I had a patient who, had a tick infestation embedded vaginally, and she had flushed one down the toilet, you know, a few days before, and actually was told by her doctor it's possible that it just crawls back up, and it actually could have.
I've seen that happen with sinks before. Somebody in the office had a tick. It wasn't embedded, but they pulled it off and put it in the sink, and it crawled right back up the sink again.
All right. So I would say, like, in that, like, case, like, extreme, you know, and thinking about the dryer and putting your clothes in, like, the extreme heat that would cause it to, you know, die potentially, you know, that might not happen if you were to just flush it down the toilet. And I think it's reasonable. I mean, most people are going to do some level of trying to actually kill it and making sure, but they are kind of hard to kill. Like, if you've ever tried to kill one, they are a little bit difficult to kill. So, you know, make sure, you know, if you really are going down that route, like, you know, then you throw it away and dispose of it somewhere that it's, you know, it's met its mortal coil.
Oh, the last time I took it, I put it in a little jar and I sealed it and put it in the trash.
That's what I actually often do, either a jar or a baggie, and you just keep it in, and then it just eventually does die.
I heard that if you put some coffee grounds in like a Ziploc with it,
yeah, I'm going to get a blowtorch.
Blowtorch, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you mentioned guinea hens.
Yeah, guinea hens apparently really love ticks. So lots of people, you know, bring them just to eat the ticks in the local area. I know that they have them up in Wilton and running around the yard up there. And I mean, not everybody's going to be, you know, have the ability to do that. But I think it's interesting. And I think, you know, if they want to eat them, then why not? You know, I mean, that seems reasonable. So,
are there any good herbal infusions that we could drink on a regular basis to repel them?
Okay, well, that's, again, I go back to neem. And, you know, as I mentioned in this show, you know, the way that I approach things is really from a constitutional standpoint. So in thinking about what could everybody do is not usually how I approach it.
Okay.
But I do think that depending on your constitution, there are some really great herbs that are extremely supportive. And I will say that I have used a lot now with the neem. When I was talking about neem using it as an insect repellent before, the neem seed is actually what is often used as, the neem seed and leaf can be used as an insect repellent, but the neem seed is actually more toxic. So you don't take the seed internally, you take the leaf internally. Okay. And so typically what I do if I put people on neem is I will give them like a neem oil that they could apply to topically. There are some neem sprays that you can also use, and then, you know, taking the neem internally. I have lots of clients that have used neem and feel that it is actually one of the things, and they give it actually to their dogs or to their, you know, their felines, the cats, to take internally, like a couple caps here or there during tick season. And the unique thing about neem is that it actually affects the reproductive cycle. So the ticks naturally repel, or organism or microbiology, other insects repel it. And this is one of the things that they did with the research with neem, that it has this specific action on the reproductive cycle of whatever the organism is. And so there's a natural repellent activity. And so I would say, I would like to see more people using that, because I think there's some valid research that's out there about this particular plant, and it's used widely in India for, as a, you know, again, across, you know, very broad spectrum, you know, antibiotic, you know, antiviral, antifungal. And so that's internal and external and used, and it's very safe to use in the garden. So that's something that I would say is really worth, you know, considering.
Can you get neem at like a whole health food store?
Yeah, you probably, any local health food store. I would say, and looking, I don't know about the repellent. I know some of the other companies that sell the repellent. I don't know what they're selling at the local health food stores, but I'm for sure you could probably get neem caps.
Do our pets get Lyme disease?
Absolutely.
Really?
Definitely.
Okay, so
I think the canine.
So if you get scratched or bit by a dog or something like that, could you contract it that way?
So, you know, what I tell my clients, because I've seen multiple families that have come in that have the same diagnosis as their family dog.
Really?
And so I've had several clients that have been diagnosed with Lyme and babesiosis, and the dog has the same illness, or Lyme and Ehrlichia, which is another tick-borne illness. And so one of the things that I would say, I'm really cautious about, you know, just be careful. You know, I think always like, all right, they've isolated this in almost any tissue. They haven't, you know, done studies necessarily between canines and humans, not that I know of.
Right.
But, you know, if you know that your dog has Lyme disease, you know, probably keep, you know, the kissing down to a minimum, you know, or eliminate.
Right, you don't have to be bit. You could just be licked, right? Seriously.
True.
Yeah, don't make out with your dog, Mike.
Okay.
Oh, my. Okay, on that note, as we wrap up here, Dr. Miklas, can you think of any last words that someone might like to hear to help with this fear of this disease, and really so we can feel more empowered of how to handle it?
Well, it was interesting when you said, like, I have clients that want to move to New Mexico, and I don't think Lyme's going away. I think it's here, and that we need more awareness, and we need to be vigilant about how we treat. And, you know, it's multifactorial, and there's many things that we can do to open our eyes about this. I think really what it comes down to is education and really understanding the prevalence. And as a clinician, really being able to use it as a differential widely and say, like, okay, well, we're in a tick endemic area. I've treated this person for multiple things. You know, I've had many cases where the person's like been diagnosed with hypothyroidism, maybe Hashimoto's, and they've been treated, you know, and they're not getting better. Like, well, why are they not getting better? As a clinician, if somebody's not getting better with good treatment, I have to ask myself, it's either the treatment or I'm missing something. So Lyme can be a huge obstacle to cure. And if you think that the person has some other illness, it's often not only Lyme. And, you know, we didn't really get into co-infections that much, but co-infections, one of things, other viral. I see a lot of patients that have a history of mononucleosis and then they acquired, you know, Lyme disease, and they're the sickest people I've ever seen in clinical practice. You know, there's other things that are potentially going on with an individual, but to not actually consider Lyme because it doesn't present either as a joint disease or a neurological disease or an erythema migrans, in my opinion, is a huge mistake in an endemic area. And so if we could have, as a collective, more awareness as this being a differential diagnosis, and I've said many, many times, hey, what's the harm in doing a Western blot for your client? You know, there's no problem with doing, you know, the testing, in my opinion. Just do the testing and see what you see. And more often than not, you're going to catch a diagnosis. This is a very underdiagnosed disease. We know this. I know this. The 400 physicians around me should know this. At the Center for Disease Control knows this. Harvard University knows this. Everybody knows that this is an underdiagnosed disease. We need to put ourselves, you know, we need to have an advantage over, a disease that is underdiagnosed. And we need to hone our clinical skills in order to be able to really clinically diagnose a clinical diagnosis, which is what Lyme disease is.
Well, and it sounds like for people listening who maybe think, well, wow, I'm just not getting better. My doctor, you know, is treating me for this condition or this symptom, and I'm not getting better. Maybe the answer is to really seek out a clinician who has more knowledge in Lyme and who can properly diagnose and give you the right protocols.
And I might get into trouble for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyhow. And when in doubt, think Lyme, especially in a tick endemic area, because at the end of the day, you know, it's the great mimicker of disease, just like syphilis. And so put your clinical hats on and really think about this as being something that is a great potential if your patient's not getting better.
You know, if this is so great in this, if it's such an epidemic in this area, why are there more doctors turning their heads the other way and not even testing patients that clearly have so many symptoms of it?
Well, I think that the gap lies in a couple of areas. One is, I think there's a lot of great doctors around here that are really working hard. You know, I'm not just saying naturopaths, medical doctors, nurse practitioners, everybody's trying to work hard to help their patients. Lots of people have too many patients, and, you know, it's a function of our, you know, again, kind of like the environment, it's a function of our healthcare system. But what I would say is that I think the gap lies in, you know, really having the right information. Lots of people have criticized, you know, the Center for Disease Control and the Infectious Disease Society of America for having, you know, out-of-date guidelines based on Lyme disease that were established at a time when we didn't know as much. And so, you know, if those guidelines aren't meeting our needs, then I think we have to progress regardless. And so in having more awareness and understanding, I work with so many primary care doctors, internal medicine, endocrinologists, that are, will actually say, hey, go to Dr. Michaelis for Lyme disease because she really does know and I don't know. Right. You know, I think it's coming to terms with saying, I don't know. You know, this is something else. But not closing the door and saying, you know, I have a patient who came in who is on 3 blood pressure medications, within, you know, 2 months on 10 other medications, you know, for, you know, depression and all these other things and anxiety, and his blood pressure is persisting. And I said, oh my gosh, this guy's out in the woods every day. I bet he has Lyme disease. Lo and behold, right? He has Lyme disease. And so when you start to see a patient unravel in that way, you have to ask the question, what is going on? If it's a normal, healthy individual and all of a sudden onset of illness, I would say this is a big marker in my clinical practice. Sudden onset, everything's good, everything's humming along nicely, life's smooth sailing, and all of a sudden, boom, you get hit with something and you're laid out in your back and, you know, all of a sudden you're getting diagnosed with depression. Bad diagnosis. Get something else on board here and understand like there's potentially something like a Lyme disease or an Ehrlichia or a babesiosis or even something else, some other infectious disease or some other obstacle to cure that's big enough to really, you know, alter a person's health in that way, which doesn't happen. It has to be something bigger, amen, in my opinion.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Miklas, for just engaging in such a difficult topic. You know, this is a far-reaching disease that seems to have a lot of creating a lot of confusion among people. So, just having this conversation to start a dialogue for people to start to get answers for them. And I agree, it's so individualistic. So, I hope that we've at least given some hope and some information that will help people. And again, if you want to contact Dr. Miklas directly, please do. Her website is livingnaturalinc.com. Living Natural Inc. is in Nashua, New Hampshire. Her phone number is 603-594-0002. And Dr. Miklas, if someone's listening in a different part of the country and they're looking for a specialist in Lyme disease, what's the best way for them to find someone?
I'm so glad you asked. So people can actually contact ILADS, which is the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. I think it's ILADS.org, but if you just Google ILADS, you should find it. Again, International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. The other organization that I would like to steer people towards is Turn the Corner Foundation. They were really involved with the movie Under Our Skin, and they're a great foundation for connecting doctors and patients, and that's across the country. So also the CALDA, the California Association of Lyme Disease. I think it's CALDA. They're great. There's another organization called Lyme-Induced Autism, LIA. You can find them online. So there are multiple organizations, and I would say, you know, as far as labs are concerned, there's several labs that I think are reasonable. Stony Brook Hospital in New York is a great hospital that does some good tick-borne testing. Igenex is another one. Clongen Labs in Maryland. All of those labs are excellent labs to either send ticks to and or to, I think actually Stony Brook might even do tick testing for free. So, yeah.
Fantastic information. Thank you so much. And we hope to have you back again to just continue this conversation.
And if you enjoy this podcast or you know somebody that has Lyme disease or may suspect that they do, please share this with them, either on Facebook or in an email or however.
Great. Thank you so much. Be well, everybody.
You've been listening to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it. For more information, go to spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call Dr. Jennifer at 603-673-5600. That's spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call 603-673-5600.